You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko otou tōku ingoa. Nau mai hari mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Otto, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Max. Efai Akine coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March. We've talked about the government pulling out of the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, the government's plan to electronically monitor asylum seekers, and Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith's sentencing reforms. I spoke to Will Appleby from Greenpeace Aotearoa about a new study uncovering high levels of nitrate contamination in rural freshwater bodies. And I speak to Dr. Jamie Monk, a research fellow at Motu Economic and Public Policy Research, about a study she conducted uncovering the links between public housing stability and child well-being. Max, what have you got for us today?
I speak with Bill Mackay to talk about the healthy home standards being introduced. And I also spoke to Boyd Swinburne to talk about the weight loss drug Wegovy being available for prescription in New Zealand.
Hey, aha o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai. Text in on 5395 or waia mai rānei. Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e āhe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero. Anō hi pakiheri rokiroki marunga e te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Last week, it was revealed that the government had withdrawn New Zealand from the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, an international coalition dedicated to phasing out the use of fossil fuels. This was confirmed by Climate Change Minister Simon Watts, who said that the exit from the alliance was prompted by the government's repeal of the oil and gas exploration ban. In that same week, Immigration Minister Erica Stanford recently announced that the government was looking to electronically monitor some asylum seekers and migrants in preparation for mass arrivals of asylum seekers by plane. And just recently, Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith introduced a number of sentencing reforms that included capping the discounts judges could give to offenders and treating one-punch attacks as separate offenses. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, we spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March for the party's take on all of these issues.
To begin, can you tell us about the Green Party's reaction to the government's withdrawal from the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance?
It's embarrassing for our country and an admission that this isn't a government that is taking our climate commitments seriously. I mean, the reintroduction of offshore gas and oil exploration speaks volumes to the government's plans to not tackle the climate crisis, but actually not even modernize our economy to one that runs on clean energy and actually has investment in much more productive and actually even within the government's own framework, probably profitable sectors that they could be investing in.
Do you think that this withdrawal could have an impact on New Zealand's international reputation, especially with other members of the alliance?
Absolutely. I mean, New Zealand brands itself as being a clean, green country that serves a purpose, for example, when it comes to attracting tourists. But beyond all, it reflects a dangerous turn for many Western countries into using climate denialist rhetoric to push agendas that actually will leave many low-income communities worse off, because we've got to remember that it is everyday working people that pay the highest price of not addressing the climate crisis. And we're already seeing how, for example, in Australia, they're being hit time and time again by extreme weather events that used to be seen as once in a 100-year type events, and now they're becoming frequent.
Additionally, how do you expect the withdrawal to impact our relationship with our neighbours in the Pacific?
Well, I think it once again undermines our ability to form diplomatic relationships based on respect and trust. Pacific Island nations whose livelihoods are literally at risk expect us to take the climate crisis seriously, because it is their livelihoods and their survival that it is being put at risk by people in positions of power neglecting addressing the climate crisis.
Simon Watts has said that the government was still committed to meeting New Zealand's climate targets and that natural gas exploration would be needed for New Zealand's energy transition until viable alternatives came into place. How would you respond to that?
Just that he's lying, and it's just simply not true. The government cannot be both reinstating offshore gas and oil exploration, mining for things like coal, and claiming that a few investments here and there in renewable energy will make up for it. The reality is that we do need far more renewable energy. We need, for example, to invest in cleaner transport options such as rail, and the government isn't doing any of that. So I don't know if he's taking voters for fools, but he's just simply not correct when he says that.
And the withdrawal from this alliance was revealed a day after the Greens found that the government's investment into new gas fields violated our free trade agreements. How will the Greens challenge the government's oil and gas exploration policies?
As we have done so throughout this term, which is ensuring that we hold the Prime Minister to account in the House, but actually that we send a clear message to voters that we will turn back the move from this government to basically ignore the science, ignore the evidence, and we'll reinstate the ban on offshore gas and oil exploration, invest in things like rail and renewables so that we can have an economy that actually serves everyone, not just the mining and oil company CEOs.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Immigration Minister Erica Stanford recently announced that the government was looking to electronically monitor some asylum seekers and migrants in preparation for the mass arrivals of asylum seekers by plane. The Immigration Fiscal Sustainability and System Integrity Amendment Bill, which is introducing this measure, is based on a series of recommendations from a review by Victoria Casey, which concluded that long-term detention of refugee claimants in correction facilities was inhumane. So my next question is, what is the Green Party's position on the amendments to our immigration laws, particularly the electronic monitoring of asylum seekers?
Yeah, I'm going to call BS on the framing by the government that this is following recommendations by the Casey report, because the reality is the previous Labour government introduced this mass arrival legislation which allowed for detention of asylum seekers arriving by planes or by boats. This was supported by the National Party, and it's a shameful track record by the Labour Party to basically push a bill that was opposed by basically every human rights organization in the country. The monitoring of asylum seekers is a restriction on their rights. To detain them is a political choice, and so is to electronically monitor them. It's important to note that asylum seekers in this country are not being adequately supported. When we talk about people that are escaping some of the most horrible forms of persecution, so we are opposing this bill and condemn both the Labour Party for enabling the conditions for this to happen and the National Party for pushing forward with this rights-undermining bill.
Is electronic monitoring a better alternative to long-term detention?
Yeah, well, the point is that we should not need long-term detention. It's not needed. The politicians have basically lied to us to create a scenario where they're now presenting these two false binaries that they're telling us it's either long-term detention or electronic monitoring. When so what we could do is, for example, better resource, for example, you know, organizations like Community Law that ends up being supporting many of the asylum seeking claims, organizations like the Asylum Seeker Support Trust and many others who actually end up making those asylum seeking claims processes a lot faster, taking away the need for tactics such as monitoring or even detention as claimed by this government.
How should the government assess asylum seekers who pose potential security risks?
The first thing here is that no government has been able to substantiate to the public the real supposedly claimed risk that we're about to be having the so-called mass arrivals by boat and by plane. It's a term that's been used by governments time and time again. And the idea that asylum seekers overall could pose a threat is a lie. The biggest terrorist attack that we had in this country did not come from an asylum seeker. It came from a white supremacist. And so the idea that asylum seekers inherently pose a national security threat ignores the fact of where the violence has predominantly come from in this country, which is not via asylum seekers.
The bill introducing this measure also introduces new rules for dawn raids, where a judge would decide whether Immigration New Zealand could make out-of-hours visits to the homes of those suspected of breaching their visas. Can you tell us about the potential implications that might come from this as well?
Out-of-hour visits are simply not needed. The reality is that for far too long, Immigration New Zealand has used intimidatory tactics, whether it is to threaten out-of-hour visits or simply to have compliance officers bully people into leaving. And so what we would do instead is just remove the need for out-of-hour visits altogether rather than passing this on to the judiciary. I think there is far more we can do to strengthen the rights of people who currently don't have a visa because of a failure in the system. And I don't think this bill overall helps to do that, particularly when it undermines the rights of asylum seekers alongside it.
All right, moving on to the last topic. In the past few days, Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith has introduced a number of sentencing reforms, among which are capping the discounts judges can give to offenders, especially on the basis of young age and remorse, as well as higher penalties for people assaulting first responders and treating one-punch attacks as separate offenses. So my next question is, what is the Green Party's take on Paul Goldsmith's recent sentencing reforms?
What we know these reforms will do is massively increase the prison population. What we know is that then the taxpayers will be forking out billions of dollars and maintaining expensive prisons that do very little to actually end and reduce violence in our communities, because prisons do not rehabilitate people. The problem that we have is that when people are committing crimes, the last thing they're often thinking about are the consequences and the sentencing. I would say most politicians probably don't even know, for example, if you brought a case study, how much time in prison they would get. So this does not address where crime comes from. For example, another reform that was announced was around increasing penalties for shoplifting. I would say most people shoplifting would probably be more thinking about their own survival and the family survival, especially if they're shoplifting from a supermarket, rather than, or for example, have underlying mental health issues that need addressed, rather than thinking, oh, what's the sentence I'm going to get because of doing this desperate and probably not rational action.
So just to reiterate, will harsher sentencing for violent crimes, such as one-punch attacks, have any impact on violent offences?
We don't believe it will actually reduce violence in our communities. What it will do is put a really heavy bill on taxpayers due to the increased prison population, ruin people's lives, and actually just entrench the cycle of violence and incarceration. So this actually does not go any way towards addressing violence in our communities.
And lastly, what sentencing or judicial reforms would a Greens-led government introduce to keep our streets safer?
For example, when it comes to issues like shoplifting, which the government has focused a lot this week, we would address issues like inequality and poverty. We also think that people deserve better access to things like legal aid. And we also need better city planning and infrastructure to, for example, have cities that are inherently safer and better designed, so that we don't have the kind of spaces that end up creating violence in our community. Finally, I want to say that the government's lack of adequate commitment to addressing and supporting Te Arere Kura, the plan to end family and sexual violence, speaks volumes. They could actually be better resourcing the organizations that help work closely with families to prevent violence in our community.
And that was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March talking to us about the government's withdrawal from the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, their plan to electronically monitor asylum seekers, and Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith's sentencing reforms.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government. We do.
The Wire.
Recently, the Water Services Authority published their Taumata Arawai report, analysing the state of drinking water safety. The report found that 7 registered water supplies had exceeded levels of nitrate contamination, carrying possible risks of increased risk of preterm birth and other health conditions for a number of rural communities in the North Island. I spoke with Greenpeace Aotearoa's freshwater spokesperson Will Appleby, who says that the contamination of water supplies, largely caused by industrial agricultural output, is linked to the government's removal of freshwater protections and their planned changes to the Resource Management Act.
Can you give us a rundown on the findings from the Taumata Arawai report and nitrate contamination of rural water supplies?
Yeah, so this new report just came out this week, and it shows that 7 registered water supplies in 2024 tested for levels of nitrate that exceeds the level associated with an increased risk of preterm birth. It also reported that there were 4 samples that were notified to Taumata Arawai that exceeded the maximum allowable value for nitrate contamination, which is 11.4 milligrams per litre. And it's worth keeping in mind that the legal limit for nitrate is woefully out of date, 11.3 milligrams per litre. That was set in the 1950s to avoid blue baby syndrome. But a lot of the recent science has shown that there is other risks associated with much lower levels of nitrate contamination, as low as 1 milligram per litre. Long-term exposure could increase your risk of colorectal cancer, for example, by 4%. So these figures are really concerning, and it comes at the same time as the government is consulting on proposals that would actually roll back freshwater protections rather than strengthen them, which is what we need to be doing right now.
Can you tell us about the source of this nitrate contamination and which actors are largely responsible for it?
Yeah, so a major source of nitrate contamination in New Zealand is the overuse of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer in intensive dairying. Because it's such an intensive form of agriculture, it needs a lot of inputs like fertilizer and irrigation. And that is a large contributor to elevated levels of nitrate in groundwater. And it's worse in some parts of the country, particularly in Canterbury, as a hotspot for nitrate contamination because there is so much dairying in the region. And it's also not an area that's particularly suited to dairy farming. And the landscape is such that there's very rocky, porous soils in Canterbury that makes it much easier for nitrates to leach into the groundwater.
And you touched on this a little bit earlier, but how is this nitrate contamination linked to the government's freshwater policies?
Well, nitrate contamination has been a growing concern for quite some time, but there are several proposals that the government is released for consultation at the moment. One of the most concerning ones is a repeal on the synthetic nitrogen fertiliser cap. So in 2020, a limit was set at 190 kilograms per hectare of synthetic nitrogen fertiliser. And this was quite groundbreaking because it shifted the conversation away from dealing with pollution once it's in the environment towards actually limiting pollution before it can cause harm. And so the government has proposed scrapping that cap. They've also proposed making it easier for irrigation schemes to build irrigation water storage ponds and picking apart and undermining various parts of our freshwater regulations. And the end result will be that they are prioritising corporate profits ahead of the health of communities, and lakes, rivers and communities' access to safe drinking water will suffer as a result.
Additionally, how will the government's planned changes to the Resource Management Act impact this issue?
So the proposals at the moment, they are part of their resource management reforms. They've said that they want to repeal the Resource Management Act. That will take quite some time. So the proposals they've released at the moment are amendments to various pieces of regulation to try and put some of those changes in place sooner rather than later. And so the overall reforms that they want to make to resource management will have a large impact on this. What they've proposed right now, they would enable dairy expansion, they'll enable further intensification of intensive dairy farming, which means more cows, it means more dairy pollution, contaminating waterways with nitrates and pathogens like E. coli. And it's coming at a time where we need to be doing more to protect freshwater. Everyone in the country should be able to swim in the local rivers or drink from their kitchen tap without worrying about getting sick. But that's not the case for a lot of people. So we actually need to be doing more to protect freshwater and reversing degradation.
You touched on this a little bit earlier as well, but what are some of the specific health impacts or conditions that we can possibly expect in the affected communities as a result of this?
Yeah, so there's a growing body of evidence that shows that there is an increased risk of colorectal cancer associated with long-term exposure to nitrate contamination. The risk of bowel cancer could be increased by 4% with long-term exposure to nitrate levels as low as 1 milligram per litre. And the New Zealand College of Midwives, they actually recommend to pregnant people that if their drinking water is above 5 milligrams per litre, that they find another source of water or consider finding another source of water because there's an increased risk of preterm birth. And these are health risks that aren't reflected in the current drinking water standards. We should be taking a precautionary approach and setting much lower limits for nitrate contamination to avoid potential adverse health outcomes. And these changes that the government is currently proposing is likely going to make the problem worse in terms of nitrate contamination.
And how will Greenpeace be holding the government and companies responsible for this nitrate contamination accountable?
Yeah, so we're pushing back quite strongly against these new proposals. We're encouraging everyone to submit against them. There are a lot of proposals, but the direction of travel is clear. They want to prioritise corporate profits ahead of the health of lakes and rivers and the health of communities and their access to safe drinking water. Right now, a core principle of our regulations is that the health of waterways, freshwater, and the health of communities should be prioritised ahead of corporate uses of water, like intensive dairying. They want to change that, and it goes against that core principle, and we're pushing back on that. We're encouraging everyone to submit against it, and we encourage people here to our website to learn how they can submit on these proposed changes.
All right, well, that's about everything from me, but is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish off?
Yeah, so everyone should be able to drink the water from their kitchen tap without worrying about getting sick, but for 20% of the country at the moment, that's not the case. To reverse the degradation that's already occurred as a result of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer and its overuse in the intensive dairy sector, we need to be limiting its use now rather than later. These proposals would do the opposite. We're sending a clear message to the government that they need to prioritize the health of communities and the public rather than corporate dairy interests.
And that was Greenpeace Aotearoa's freshwater spokesperson, Will Appleby, speaking to us about the nitrate contamination of rural freshwater bodies. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
95.
If music is the food of love, then we hope you're hungry, because you've got a ticket to the buffet.
Love language.
If music is the fuel of love, then vroom vroom, baby, it's time to hop on board.
Love language.
And if music is the language of love, then you better tune in to Love Language to stay literate.
Love language.
Spend some quality time with your Love Language hosts, Carlotta and Scarlett. 9 to 11 p.m. on the last three Saturdays of every month. Right here on 95BFM.
Do you growl towards the weekend on a Friday afternoon like the cockroach that hides in the corner of your room and crawls towards your sleeping face at night to slither inside your ear and lay its eggs?
Well, it's lucky we have this show to jolt you awake and stop all that disgusting crawling.
It's the Friday 2 to 4
with a brain-birthing cast of DJs ready to get you hyped for the weekend.
Yes, indeed. Oh, this is we're not passing judgment here.
Okay. It's just science.
It's just science. Yeah.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text it on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. As of the 1st of July 2025, the Healthy Home Standards have kicked in. This requires all rental properties to meet the regulations designed to improve renters' health by preventing damp, moldy, and cold conditions. Now that the final deadline has passed, landlords who fail to comply with the standards could face fines of up to $7,200. The only problem is who might be regulating them. To break down what this means for renters, landlords, and the wider housing sector, I spoke to Bill Mackay from the School of Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland.
Could you explain why the Healthy Home Standards have been introduced?
Basically, we know in New Zealand that we've got really poor housing stock. We live in kind of cold, damp houses with inadequate heating. And we also know that rentals are generally worse in standard than the average home, you know, where the occupier, the owner occupier. So this is kind of an attempt to bring them up to a minimal standard. I don't really like the name Healthy Homes because we know we can make homes a hell of a lot healthier. Really, it's just improving the minimum standards.
How much of an impact will these standards have on tenants' health and well-being?
Hopefully, they should improve things because, you know, we will be increasing generally the amount of insulation. There'll be ventilation, such as, you know, kitchens and bathrooms have to have a little mechanical fan now, a few things like that. So also kind of stopping a lot of drafts, that kind of thing. So I think things will improve slightly. I just think that we've got a system at the moment where we're reliant on the landlord to self-certify. So they're not having kind of external inspectors to make sure the landlord's done the work and done the work properly.
Why is it that the landlords are the ones enforcing it, and is that acceptable?
Yeah, so basically your landlord can self-certify, and some people have likened it to, you know, if you're in a car doing your own warranty for fitness. We know that that sort of system is not going to work very well, and there are a lot of bad landlords out there, so I do worry that bad landlords will just kind of get away with things. They apparently are doing some sort of spot checks on rentals, but I don't know how frequent and, you know, how few and far between they will be. Another aspect is kind of, there's a lot of information on the Healthy Homes there. So if you're a tenant, you can look it up online. One of the best sites is Tenancy Services, which comes out of the big government ministry called MB. You can have a look. There's a checklist on there. But the problem with that is if you think that your home that you're renting is not up to standard, the first thing you do is approach the landlord. And we know that a lot of tenants don't like approaching the landlord because, you know, they might get chucked out or something like that.
Who would you say should be enforcing this then?
I think we should have more of a kind of inspection system. Even some property managers who manage properties on behalf of landlords, they're doing the compliance paperwork and that sort of thing as well. But even, you know, many of those are good, but also many of them are not up to scratch either. You know, I had personal experience of a rental that one of my kids was in where none of the smoke alarms worked, you know, so kind of. And that's a pretty basic thing to get right.
And you likened it to if car owners were to do their own warrant of fitness. Wouldn't you say that if car owners were required to do their own warrant of fitness, that the standards of car safety would drop as well?
Definitely. That's why we don't do it like that. You know, it's just too risky. It's too dangerous. When a car is rocketing down the road at 100k, you might think, well, that's a lot more dangerous than a kind of a house. But we also know that the living conditions in the average house in New Zealand, you know, cold and damp, they can cause all sorts of respiratory illnesses, especially in kids, young kids. So, you know, houses can be as dangerous as vehicles.
Do you think that there's a risk that these regulations could force landlords to raise rent for tenants or even reduce the number of properties for rent overall?
Yeah, I have heard of a few cases that's been reported that some landlords with some houses are just going, this is going to be too difficult to get up to scratch, so they're selling them. So, you know, I don't know if another landlord would buy one or a first home owner would buy it as a do-up or something like that. Yeah, but I can see definitely landlords putting the price up for the work that they've done. They shouldn't really be doing that, but there's nothing to stop them raising the rent.
Would you say overall that the implementation of these standards significantly improves Aotearoa's rental housing stock?
It brings it up to a slightly higher standard, but I wouldn't say it significantly improves. You know, so for example, you can't just have a plug-in electric heater. You have to put in something decent like a fixed electrical heater or a fixed gas heater or a heat pump. But kind of, if it costs too much to turn that on, the tenant's just not going to operate it. So there we've got the heating in the house, but if the heating's not being used, well, it's not raising standards at all.
What's the next step to improve housing quality in New Zealand?
We need to build a lot better. We still have fairly kind of low standards of housing. We also have a thing in New Zealand called existing use rights. So if your house doesn't meet, you know, if your house is 50, 70 years old and doesn't meet the building code, you don't have to do anything about it because of your existing use rights. So we just carry on living in kind of fairly poor quality houses.
And that was Bill Mackay on the rollout of the Healthy Home Standards and their potential impact on rental housing across the country.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
A study was recently conducted by Motu Economic and Public Policy Research comparing outcomes for children living in public housing with their peers living in privately owned homes. The study found that children aged between 0 to 9 who lived in public housing faced a number of disadvantages, exhibiting higher levels of behavioral difficulties in early childhood. I spoke to Dr. Jamie Monk, a research fellow at Motu, about the study and the links between public housing and children's well-being. To begin, can you give us a rundown on the study you conducted about how stable housing impacts child well-being?
So we're getting internationally now a lot more evidence about the importance of the first 1,000 days or the early years on kids' long-term development. And most of kids, most of the time they have as little ones is at spent at home. So housing is incredibly important in terms of their picture for long-term development. And we also know in Aotearoa, we have very high percentage of our household income gets spent on housing compared with other countries, despite the fact that the quality of our houses is actually pretty low. And so what we decided to do is we used some data from the Growing Up in New Zealand study. And so there's nearly 7,000 children that we look at. And we look at their housing tenure or what type of housing they were living in when they were babies, and then map their well-being over time through to 12 years of age. So we look at from 2 to 9 years, their social and emotional development, and then at 12 years of age, we look at data that kids have told the study themselves about their quality of life.
So how do children who start their lives in public housing fare when compared to their peers in privately owned homes?
So initial, or at 2 years of age, we see quite big differences. So these kids, well, differences in the more negative measures, I should say. So they have greater behaviour problems, these sorts of things. But over time, what we see is a convergence. And so by the time they get to 9 years of age, the differences are a lot smaller. And at 12 years of age, when we ask how they see their own quality of life, it's pretty much the same. We do also use a measure of pro-social behaviour, or how kind and caring these children are. And those, when we look at that measure, it's the same across kids' development, no matter what housing phenotype they started in.
So what are the aspects of public housing that impact children's well-being at that stage of their life?
Three pathways here. I think there's a financial aspect to it in terms of the fact that rent's kept and it gives a financial security to families. And other research I've done shows that that has a positive impact on parents' ability to parent. So they have more engaged parenting when financial stress is lower. I think there's a quality aspect. There's public houses, particularly when this data was collected, were of a slightly better quality than the equivalent houses that these families would be able to afford in the private rental market. And that has a positive effect on the family functioning as a whole if the house is warm, but also on children's health outcomes. And there's also a security of tenure that happens in public housing. So families can have that sort of security that they can stay where they are. And that's beneficial for the family as a whole as well.
Are there any other factors outside housing that have an impact on child well-being, particularly towards the later stages of their development?
Yeah, so the other factors at that stage is definitely to do with relationships. So relationships, this is with the associations that we found, relationships with the important adults in their lives, so parents and teachers, bullying was a big factor that affects kids' reported quality of life. So the more often they were bullied, the lower their quality of life. And interestingly, time outdoors as well. So the more often kids were outside, the higher they reported their quality of life.
You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but how does New Zealand fare when it comes to child well-being and providing housing for tamariki, especially compared to other OECD countries?
Yeah, we have lower rates of public housing, so 4% in New Zealand versus about 7% in the OECD. And so that means there's a large group of families that are facing disadvantages for various reasons that don't have access to public housing, and instead they're on the private rental market, which has its own challenges. We have some lower sort of protections for tenants and things like that, and so there's a really substantive group of families that face very insecure and poor quality housing in New Zealand.
Are there any examples of public housing models in other countries that have also led to positive developmental outcomes for children?
There's different studies on different aspects of housing. I think the thing with housing is so context dependent. And that's why research in Aotearoa is important, because each society has got different ways of structuring both housing support but also social service support, and different ways families support each other and different ways families live. But I think consistently across the evidence, the fact is that if housing is secure, if it's of a high quality and is affordable, then that really supports kids' development.
So lastly, what steps do we need to take here in New Zealand to improve outcomes for children who grow up in public housing?
I think that we really just need to be supporting families as best we can. Across, there's never a silver bullet when it comes to helping families, but I think providing adequate income, whether that comes through employment or whether that comes through social support, is really important so that families have that security to be able to parent properly and to have give kids the necessary things they need for life. I'm always passionate in talking, as my research as a whole, about decreasing stress for parents, whether it's financial stress or stress in terms of engaging with government agencies, and having a security around life that's really important for families too.
And that was Dr. Jamie Monk, a research fellow at Motu Economic and Public Policy Research, talking to us about a study she conducted uncovering the links between public housing stability and child well-being. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
Tipsy, topsy, slurs. 95 BFM.
Eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM. Once again, let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879. Wegovy, also known as Ozempic, when marketed in lower doses, is a weight loss drug that is already making headlines globally. And now, as of the 1st of July, it's available for prescription in Aotearoa. Given that New Zealand is currently ranked 31st in the world for obesity rates, according to the World Obesity Federation, some experts believe Wegovy could have a major impact on obesity levels nationwide, especially if it were to become publicly funded. To talk about why the drug isn't publicly funded at the moment, and what kind of impact Wegovy could have on obesity in Aotearoa, I spoke with Boyd Swinburne, Professor of Population, Nutrition and Global Health at the University of Auckland.
Could you explain what Wegovy or Ozempic is and how it works as a weight loss drug?
So this is a new class of weight loss drugs, and it came from understanding the physiology of appetite control. And so it's a particular hormone, GLP-1, which was identified as being, if you like, the conductor of the appetite orchestra. It also has an effect on blood sugar control, which is why the drug is good for diabetes as well. But this weight loss effect comes largely through reducing appetite, increasing sense of fullness, less hunger and so on. And so the drugs are now analogs, or if you like, copies or copies of some similar molecules to this hormone. And there's lots of different ones that are now coming on the market and being developed, but they're all essentially the single class of drugs.
What do the studies behind Wegovy say about its success rate or impact among users?
So the impact is really quite significant. Most of the weight loss drugs we've had to date have not been very effective. It's been a sort of like a 5% maybe maximum effect of weight loss, and often with a lot of side effects. So this is a big step up from there. It's like 10 to 15% of weight loss. And that may not sound like a lot for a person with, you know, 100 plus kilos, but gee, it has a big impact on health outcomes. It's shown to improve diabetes, prevent heart attacks, and a lot of other obesity-related issues like sleep apnea and so on. So, yeah, there's a lot of data, a lot of trials showing its effect, not just on weight loss, but also the diseases associated with it.
With that in mind, what kind of impact do you think Wegovy will have on obesity levels in Aotearoa?
Well, for a start, it's only for the rich because this drug, while it's been approved by MedSafe, is not on the publicly funded drugs which are run by Pharmac. So the effect will only be apparent in those who can afford it. It'll be about $500 a month, which is very steep. So I think the initial impact will be it'll help a few people who are wealthy enough to afford it, and that won't really make an impact more broadly. It's only when the drugs come off patent and the price drops substantially that they now become cost-effective for Pharmac to consider. And I'm sure that in the future, when they come off patent, the older drugs, the first generation of these drugs, will be able to be available to Pharmac at a good low price so that they'll be more widely available. And then we'll see a more sort of extensive impact of the drugs on weight loss.
Why do you think there might be a debate about funding Wegovy?
I think there's a debate about funding these drugs because there is a weight bias in society. People look at people with obesity and think that it is their personal problem, that they have a failure of willpower, that they're ignorant, they're stupid, they don't care, all that sort of thing. And that is not true. The reason for the obesity that we've got is we have a very powerful obesogenic environment, and it is dead easy to get overweight or obese. So there's a highly judgmental bias of people in this country. So if the government says we're going to fund a drug for obesity, some people will think these people do not deserve public-funded drugs. They're making value judgments and moral judgments on the value, medical value of the drug. We don't apply that same moral set of spectacles on, say, people who need blood pressure drugs or cholesterol-lowering drugs. Both of those problems, high blood pressure and high cholesterol, are present in a person because of a combination of their genes, of their lifestyle, of their diet, of their activity, and so on, just the same as obesity. But we don't make moral judgments about their deservedness of public funding to help reduce their health problems. But we do with obesity. And so the debate and all the interest, I think, is around this issue of deservedness. And really, it's a blight on society that we have this weight bias. And now it's coming out when we talk about funding of drugs.
Can you talk about how the impact of Wegovy would change if it were to be publicly funded?
Well, I think it would be much more widely available. And if you think about a distribution curve of body mass index, you know, so there are some people at the left-hand end of that curve who are lean and some people at the right-hand end of that curve, this normal distribution, who have obesity. So when this drug becomes available and is cheap and is widely prescribed, that will have an effect on the right-hand side of that distribution. So it'll bring that tail, that right-hand tail of the normal distribution in. It'll drop it down a bit. What it won't do is prevent the whole population becoming obese. There's nothing preventive in this. It won't have an effect on kids. It won't have an effect on the obesogenic environment, all the piles of fast food outlets, the cheap ultra-processed food and so on. So we're going to end up in this situation where we still have an obesogenic environment driving the problem and some drugs at the other end trying to minimize the damage for those who are most affected.
Lastly, do you think New Zealand needs to implement other measures to meaningfully reduce obesity levels?
Oh my goodness, we've been waiting for this for decades. You know, WHO has a whole stack of policies, things like sugary drinks tax, like healthy food in school, like front of pack labeling labels that are good, like marketing to kids, reducing marketing to kids. All of these policies have good evidence behind them, but they have not been implemented by successive governments. And so we just have the obesity epidemic continuing. And this is a real problem. It's a political problem. Politicians don't want to battle the food industry, and so they just let it lie, and we become a nation that is now just behind the US in the obesity stakes.
That was Professor Boyd Swindon on the potential impacts of Wegovy and the wider conversation around obesity in New Zealand.
That was The Wire.
Ko I rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Greenpeace Aotearoa's Will Appleby, Bill McKay from the University of Auckland, Research Fellow at Motu Economic and Public Policy Research, Dr. Jamie Monk, and Professor Boyd Swinburne from the University of Auckland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.